to carry on.
Welcome to the roundtable panel for this morning. It is Tuesday, the 30th of July. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, scheduled to return tomorrow. Joined in studio this morning by senior fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff. Good morning, Fred. How are you?
Good morning, Sarah. Doing well. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, also joins us. Hiya, Jay. How you feeling?
I'm feeling great after a bout of COVID. But I'm past the 10-day period.
Well passed.
Thank you for that.
Feeling good.
No, he checked.
I made sure. I tested negative yesterday.
And also, glad you're feeling better. And also here, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, our late addition, always a savior. Thank you for being here.
Hey, I had finished the Wordle and the connections, and so I was free for the rest of the morning. Glad to be here.
You're ahead of me. Are you doing strands?
I did strands, too.
Okay, I haven't done any of them, so no spoilers.
I share a subscription with a colleague, and we finally realized that it's whoever gets up early that gets to do Wordle and connections. So we said, all right, since I'm the one who gets up early all the time, I'm going to make a sacrifice. And so we alternate every other day.
That takes a lot of a level of organization.
It's a high level of what did I do yesterday? Did I do connections? Did I do Wordle? Which one was it?
So it's an extra memory memory game, memory securation, securing your mental capability by doing the puzzle and remembering if you did the puzzle.
And at my age, every little bit helps.
Right, and I couldn't tell you what today's Wordle was, even though I've already done it. So.
Yeah. You can join the conversation this morning by emailing us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. The roundtable panel music this morning is Styx and Foreigner. We heard Styx coming in. The two classic rock bands are playing at SPAC in Saratoga Springs tonight, SPAC.org for more information. And the playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. So with Fred Hoff, Jay Jochnowitz, Judy Patrick, and myself in studio, and you all knowing that you can email panel@wamc.org, let us begin. We're going to go to Israel. There's a lot of news always. But we haven't discussed this in a few days on the roundtable panel. I'll begin with this story from the New York Times. Negotiations for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip continued to be stalled on Monday, that's yesterday, with Israel and Hamas blaming each other for the failure to agree one day after senior officials from Israel, Egypt, Qatar, and the United States met in Rome for talks and mounting tensions in the region. Amid mounting tensions in the region, Hamas accused Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of continually changing the terms of the framework under discussion for a ceasefire and the release of hostages held by Hamas, which was backed by the United States and endorsed by the United Nations in June, which is about 2 months ago, depending on when in June that was, which, of course, I don't recall because time is confusing. Tensions were running high on both sides, of course, during this meeting and after and since and before. Tensions running high after a attack this weekend. Israeli Security Cabinet has authorized its leaders to decide on the nature and timing of a military response to a deadly rocket attack from Lebanon over the weekend. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, received the authorization from the cabinet members in a meeting on Sunday night, the prime minister's office said. Israeli analysts said Hezbollah was most likely aiming at a nearby army base on Mount Hermon and did not intentionally target the village, but the group's use of inaccurate rockets in an area dotted with civilian communities led to the kind of unintended consequences that risk sparking an all-out war. For months, Israel has been firing back at sites in Lebanon used by Hezbollah to launch rockets and missiles across the border, as well as killing Hezbollah commanders and fighters. A lot going on, a lot of groups involved. Lucky for us, we have someone in studio very familiar with the area and the conflict, Fred. What do we need to know? What's going on?
Well, you know, with Israel-Lebanon, when we've discussed this in the past, I think we've stressed the problem of unintended consequences. You know, each side is trying to regulate and modulate the fire that it's employing on the other side. Each side has strong interests in not seeing this thing evolve into all-out warfare. But you know, when the rockets and missiles and artillery fire and mortars start going off, there is always the possibility of a target being hit that's not necessarily intentional, but it's enough to start a round of escalation that can lead to the worst possible consequences. What happened in the Golan Heights this weekend, truly horrific. A rocket fired from Lebanese territory, apparently an Iranian-made missile with a 110-pound warhead, impacted a soccer field in the town of Mejd el-Shams, town of about 10 or 11,000 people. Druze, and I'll explain in a minute what a Druze is. Mm-hmm. But there were several kids killed, and the description of the descriptions I've read of the impact area are just absolutely horrific. The Druze are Arabs. Okay, they are not Muslims. Druze theology descends from Shia Islam, but Druze do not consider themselves to be Muslims. Their theology is very closely held within a small circle of experts. In Israel proper, the Druze people, Druze Arabs, have been supporters of Israel since the beginning of the Israeli state. When you see Arab officers in the Israel Defense Forces, some of them pretty senior, they are inevitably Druze officers. There are Druze who are fairly senior people in various Israeli cabinet ministries. It is a very important minority in Israel, and again in Israel proper, it has supported the state. Several of the announced Israeli casualties, officers and enlisted men in the Gaza Strip, have been Druze. The Druze are also important minorities in Lebanon and in Syria, and there are several in Jordan as well. The Golan Heights been occupied by Israel since 1967. Most Druze residents of the Golan Heights have declined to adopt Israeli citizenship. Most of them, 75-80%, still consider themselves to be Syrian citizens after all these years. The victims of this attack over the weekend were Druze. The government of Israel feels obligated to respond. Apparently what happened, Hezbollah was aiming at an Israeli military base a couple of miles away, but the rocket missed and landed on the soccer field instead. Hezbollah is denying all responsibility for this attack, but those denials are not credible. What seems to be the salient fact is that they fired the rocket, missed the target, and killed a bunch of innocent kids.
Judy,
does the fact that this was a Druze community and a small community where the death of 12 children, I'm sure, will resonate big time. Does that add significance to the attack? And the other question I have, why do people deny an attack when they make an attack? What is the diplomatic outcome for that? Why bother to deny it?
I think the denial is mostly a function of the realization on the part of Hezbollah's leaders that the fact that one of their munitions killed Druze has major political implications within Lebanon, where the Druze are a minority, but a very influential minority. Walid Jumblatt has been the major leader of the community in Lebanon, and for decades he's been an important political force. So I think the first instinct of Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, and the others was to say, "Oh, we had nothing to do with it. It wasn't us." But all evidence, including evidence being gathered by human rights NGOs, we're not just talking about Israeli military presented evidence. All evidence indicates that the rocket was fired from a village in Lebanon, near a village in Lebanon called Sheba, which is only, 6 or 7 miles from the target. It only took a few seconds for this rocket to reach its target, and this is why the Israeli Iron Dome system was unable to intercept it. So it's extraordinarily dangerous. What Lebanese fear is that the Israeli retaliation will be very, very broad, and will take out a lot of Lebanese infrastructure in addition to attacks on Hezbollah military positions. This has been the pattern in the past. I suspect that if the victims, if this thing had happened in Israel proper, and if a rocket had landed on a school, most of whose students are Jewish, we already would have seen a massive Israeli response. Prime Minister Netanyahu thinks it's important, and I think he's right, to signal to the Druze community, you know, you're important too, and we're going to retaliate. But he's being much, much more deliberate about it.
So if the rocket had hit its intended target, the munitions facility, you think they would have claimed responsibility?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, they are claiming responsibility for having targeted Israeli military bases on the Golan over the weekend. And that's what makes one of the things that makes the denial in this particular incident not credible, because they were shooting up military positions not at all far from Mejd el-Shams.
Jay?
Yeah, I was trying to figure out why they would do a denial, and then, you know, as I kind of worked it out, I can't imagine Hezbollah or any terrorist group saying, "Oh, we made a mistake, we're sorry." You know, it's just, I think that's the practical aspect of it. And then when you have killed children of a non-Jewish community in the Middle East, you really don't want to take responsibility for it if you're the people who, if you're Hezbollah or Hamas for that matter. Three things that really struck me. One was, I thought the Times had the quote of the week from the guy who said, "It's really cool to wake up and find out I'm still alive." The guy in Lebanon, who's just, everybody's, just terrified of what the response is going to be. But it does seem as if Israel wants to be measured. I thought that Erdogan's flirtation with the possibility that Turkey might involve itself somehow in this whole mess, Gaza and West Bank and Golan Heights. I don't know what exactly Erdogan's talking about, and some people think it's just, political signaling. But it's a troubling thing, especially since we're talking a close U.S. ally and a NATO ally now, potentially in conflict. But this isn't the first time that Erdogan has done this, or said things like this. But as I was thinking about the whole thing, it's, looking at the negotiations and the apparent breakdown, and both sides are saying that each side is adding conditions now that make an agreement untenable. What I wonder the most, and Fred, you probably understand this better than anyone in the room anyway, that how do you negotiate in a situation where the leader of one country has said, "I am going to eradicate you"? How does Hamas, it's almost a sham of a negotiation. I mean, you want to get the hostages, but the hostages are probably the only thing keeping you from total destruction at this point. Is this are the negotiations just a, you know, a facade or a faint hope from Hamas that it might survive this?
Yeah, I think the negotiations are genuine. I mean, the United States has a person who is, you know, in my view, our most talented public servant, Bill Burns, currently the director of the CIA. He's taken the lead for the United States on these negotiations. I've known Bill for the better part of, I don't know, 30 or 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I know him well enough to know he would have no part in this if he thought that this was just some kind of a sham or a useless exercise. It's like everything else. There seems to be general agreement in principle on the outline of a negotiation, but the devil's in the details. Mm-hmm.
Panel at WAMC.org to participate in the conversation. The email address, panel@WAMC.org. Fred Hoff, Jay Jochnowitz, and Judy Patrick are our panel this morning. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, and we will return right after this news from the BBC. He could picture the sea. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke in for Joe Donahue, joined in studio by Senior Fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. We have discussed the attack from Lebanon, the Druze and Hezbollah. Let's talk now about the meeting in Rome and the stalled ceasefire negotiations. Negotiations for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip continued to be stalled on Monday, this from the New York Times, with Israel and Hamas blaming each other for the failure to agree, one day after senior officials from Israel, Egypt, Qatar, and the United States met in Rome for talks amid mounting tensions in the region. Hamas accused Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of changing the terms. And let's see here. It is clear from what the mediators conveyed that Netanyahu has once again returned to the strategy of procrastination, delay, and evasion from reaching an agreement by setting new conditions and demands, the group said in a statement issued on Monday. Mr. Netanyahu's office in return responded with a statement blaming Hamas for inserting new terms into the proposal. But neither side has walked away from the talks, and the search for an agreement has taken on a new urgency as the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon risks escalating further, as we were just discussing. Fred.
Yeah, it's not at all 100% clear to me that that either side really wants to bring this to closure anytime soon. What is clear is that if there is a ceasefire in Gaza, and if that ceasefire holds, that the back and forth violence across the Israel-Lebanon blue line will stop. Okay, so the ceasefire in Gaza is the key to a quieter region in general. I would imagine if there's a sustained ceasefire in Gaza, Houthi violence coming out of Yemen, violence directed at commercial shipping, drones launched in the direction of Israel, that will stop also. But the key to all of this is a ceasefire in Gaza. Iran and its Lebanese proxy, Hezbollah, were not in on the details of the October 7th operation from last year, but they definitely encouraged Hamas to do something big against Israel, to try to derail the trend of Israel being able to normalize relationships with Arab countries, Saudi Arabia being next. Iran promised Hamas, if you do something big, we'll be right in there with you. Of course, that promise was not sincere. The Iranians are quite willing, quite able to fight to the last Palestinian. Okay, and this has been this has been their policy. But the proxy in Lebanon, Hezbollah, has felt obligated since October 8th of last year to lob rockets and missiles into Israel, into the occupied Golan Heights, to demonstrate their support of the Palestinian cause. But I can almost guarantee that if a ceasefire in Gaza takes hold, that violence back and forth between Israel and Hezbollah will stop, because it's in the interests of neither side to see this go into all-out warfare.
Judy?
Man, it seems like all-out warfare now. Sometimes we're blessed to live in a country where we have peace. You know, we don't have and our country had really, since the Civil War, has never had war on our lands. And I, from my perspective, you just see the need for peace, the want of peace, and the idea that this is will have impact on the U.S. presidential election. That I would love to see it resolved so it's not an issue in the upcoming election, because I fear that will play a part in the diplomacy as well. It must be the incredible challenge for great minds to try to resolve this, because it's been going on for generations. And I just have to wonder why people don't just give up, why diplomats don't just walk away from the table. And, you know, I don't want them to do that, because, of course, people are dying every day and lives are valuable. And I would just, you know, love to see them get beyond the 10-yard line and make
Absolutely.
That goal and get some peace.
I suspect they're not going to get to the global solution that everyone would like, that, you know, peace in our time in the Middle East. But, you know, if you have peace for a year is probably what, you know, the goal is. Just stop the war in Gaza now. And as you're saying, you know, tamp down all the other little brush fires that are threatening to turn into a wildfire. One of the things that interested me in the Time story was the idea that there was, I guess, a call for and a provision for a demilitarized zone in southern Lebanon back in 2006, and it's never really been enforced. So, you know, enforcing that might help. The only thing I wonder, and, you know, Iran is always the wild card in this, how willing they are, as you said, to fight to the last Palestinian. You know, if you establish an X mile demilitarized zone, do they just give Hezbollah longer range missiles?
Look, a lot of you know, Hezbollah has somewhere between 150,000 and 200,000 rockets and missiles, mostly rockets, but also some long range missiles. If Hezbollah were to move everything north of the Litani River, which was the area mentioned in this UN Security Council resolution several years ago that's never been implemented, they could still hit Israel, most of the country. From the point of view of Iran, the main importance of Hezbollah is that this organization, with all of its rockets and missiles, and with a highly trained military force as well, is Iran's first line of deterrence against Israel. Okay, Iran wants to ensure that if Israel ever really contemplates a major attack on Iran, you know, say an aerial campaign designed to wipe out all the, you know, nuclear facilities, that Israel will have to count on the country being blanketed by rockets and missiles fired by Hezbollah. This is why Iran really doesn't want Hezbollah to use up this capability on anything else. All right, the Iranians are not at all interested in seeing all-out war between Lebanon and Israel. You had such a war in 2006, and the leader of Hezbollah admitted after the war, "I made a mistake." I mean, they had crossed the border, they had kidnapped a couple of Israeli soldiers, and things just went downhill from there. The mission of Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, is to provide Iran with a deterrent. And this guy is a true believer. He doesn't consider himself to be an Iranian stooge or agent, or he considers himself to be part of the Iranian revolution that took hold in 1979. He's a true believer, and that's his mission.
I can't help but think that Iran also, as you were saying with the election, that Iran sees an opportunity here to have an influence on U.S. Policy, if not U.S. politics, by either, you know, prolonging this or not. And I tend to think that they don't want to make the Biden administration look too weak, because it seems they don't want Trump more than they don't want Kamala Harris. But, you know, there's also the old Soviet tactic, which is just disrupt everything and keep America on its toes. Keep it off balance, keep it roiling. And the more you do that, the less effective we are foreign policy wise, because we're constantly second guessing, not just trying to figure out the international layout, but what the political ramifications are. So it's fascinating in an academic sense. It's lousy in a real life sense.
You know, it just seems like every time they get close to an agreement, like we thought that we were close to a ceasefire, then there would be something that disrupts it, like this attack that mistakenly hit the soccer field and killed 12 children. Every time, it seems like there are people who do not want peace in the Middle East, and they will do what they have to do to make sure any of these peace talks are disrupted. But you would think the people in the peace talks would say, that's just a disruption. Let's carry on.
Well, Judy, this is what they're doing. I mean, you know, every time Israel, for example, determines that it has located an important Hamas leader, okay, and launches an air assault somewhere in the Gaza Strip, you know, inevitably there are 30, 40, 50, you know, pick the number of non-combatants who are killed when this happens. And when that kind of an incident takes place, I would think at a minimum it makes it difficult for the other side to say, okay, all right, give me a pen, give me a piece of paper, I'm ready to sign. You know, and likewise, when Hamas finds itself able to launch rockets into Israel, what worries Bibi Netanyahu more than anything else is signing an agreement that causes a couple of his so-called allies in his governing coalition to leave, bringing down the government. All right, now. Before long, I don't know the exact date, but before long, the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, goes into a three-month recess, making it impossible for a vote of no confidence to be put on the floor. This could be the time that Netanyahu finds himself able to agree to a ceasefire. And that gives him a couple of months to figure out how to hold the present coalition together or stitch something together with some other ingredients.
Panel at WAMC.org is the email address listeners may use to join the conversation. And we will add some listener email to the conversation after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah Leduc for Joe Donahue. Styx and Foreigner providing our music this morning. Not that they're aware of that, but they are playing at SPAC tonight in Saratoga Springs. SPAC.org for more information. The panel this morning, Ambassador Fred Hoff, Jay Jochnowitz, and Judy Patrick. And you may join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. And that is where we heard from Janet, who says, as horrific as the killing of innocent children in Israel is, the IDF has murdered thousands of Palestinian children without comparable outrage from the media. Why is the IDF not branded a terrorist group as Hezbollah and Hamas are?
I think there's been, you know, no shortage of media coverage of the, you know, the humanitarian disaster, the humanitarian outrage that has taken place in the Gaza Strip. You know, we're approaching the point where the you know, the number of people killed in this conflict, most of whom are civilians, is reaching 40,000. This has been covered quite well. I don't feel any absence of information about this, and it really mandates a ceasefire sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I think both on the news end, I don't want to read outrage. I want to just read the facts. But on the editorial end, on the opinion end, I think, you know, columns and editorial pages have been filled with outrage about this and disappointment. And yes, they are walking it's not that they're walking a line with their readers. They're walking a line with themselves. You know, we struggle with this all the time. You know, every time there is a development there, we have a very pained discussion about, do we want to write another editorial about this? Do we want to say this has to stop one more time? No, I don't think we've been derelict in the outrage.
But there is a potential issue with reader fatigue. I mean, you get that. We got that with the Ukrainian war. There's so much human suffering out there. It's so many people who have died. So many children who are starving. And it's human nature, especially in the land of opportunity here in the wealth and prosperity, America, for us to kind of, look away and turn the channel to the Olympics. You know, it's difficult for us to keep our eye on the human suffering that's happening in the Middle East, but we need to.
And we have to ask ourselves every time we write about it, what are we going to say that's different from what we said the last time? What are we adding to the discussion? Yeah.
Oliver writes in to panel at WAMC.org and says, in blatant violation of international law, Israel has been occupying Syria's Golan Heights with military forces for how many decades now? The current wayward missile under discussion was a horrific tragedy, which would never have happened if Israel and the U.S. respected the rights and lands of native populations.
Well, yeah, I hear the listener back in 2010 to actually 2009 to 2011, I was the person in the U.S. government responsible for trying to put together a treaty of peace between Syria and Israel, one that you know, had we succeeded, had the treaty been signed, had it been implemented, and we were getting very close, if we had succeeded, then within a few years, within 3 to 5 years, Israel would have withdrawn from the Golan Heights, and the Golan Heights would have been returned to Syrian sovereignty. The thing that unfortunately killed that mediation was the decision of the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, to conduct a campaign of mass murder against his own people who were protesting aspects of his rule, in particular police brutality.
I can't imagine Israel ever giving up the Golan Heights at this point, you know, just because of the supposed protection that it affords, having, I guess, high ground.
Yeah, I mean, the prospect of renewed negotiations with somebody like Assad still running Syria are nil.
Yeah.
And it may be that history will see Bashar al-Assad as the person who conveyed the deed to the Golan Heights permanently. I won't live long enough to see it for sure. But I would hope that someday in the future, if and when Syria gets legitimate governance, okay, if and when Syria gets a government that's willing to enter into full peace with all of its neighbors, that perhaps this issue can be tabled again. But there's certainly no sign of something like that happening anytime soon.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Let's queue up a new topic that we will begin discussing, but we'll probably have to come back to after regional news. This from the Washington Post. Iran is working to stoke societal discord in the United States and undermine Donald Trump's bid to regain the White House, as it tried to do 4 years ago. U.S. intelligence officials signaled this on Monday in a new assessment of the disinformation landscape ahead of November's election. In a briefing for reporters organized by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, or the ODNI, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security, officials alluded to but stopped short of directly stating Tehran's opposition to Trump. Rather, Iran is representing the stance it took in 2020. Its leaders appear motivated by a desire to, quote, avoid an outcome they perceive would increase tensions with the United States, end quote. Officials also noted that the United States government has not detected any foreign hacking interference or tampering with election machines and websites, although officials have seen efforts to scan such networks. Russia remains a prominent threat to U.S. elections as well, the senior ODNI official said, noting Moscow's core interest is, quote, opposing candidates who want to offer further aid to Kyiv as Ukraine continues to resist Russia in an almost 2.5-year-old war. The Kremlin is using primarily Russia-based commercial firms to aid its influence operations by creating fake websites designed to impersonate U.S. government and media organizations. Two such firms have already been sanctioned for their activities. So the story really about election interference from foreign leaders, kind of generally. What have we learned? What do we think? What are we going to do?
Right. You have to check your information source because and you have to be very careful about what you share and what you believe on social media. In fact, maybe you should just give up social media and go to traditional news sources to get your information because they're wily. They're crafty. They make it look like you're the, you know, the Albany Journal. It makes it, oh, I didn't know such a newspaper exists. But they use local journalists who sometimes don't know who they're writing for, what article that they're doing. They don't understand what's happening. And it's happened before. Facebook is rife with this right now. TikTok is rife with it. And so my advice is actually don't believe anything you read on social media. Go to traditional, credible news sites. Do your homework. Be a responsible citizen. Fred, you talk about civic engagement. You're in charge of civic engagement. This is really, really important as citizens. I hate people who say, oh, I don't follow the news. I don't care about the news. You have to follow the news. That is your responsibility as a citizen. And you have to vote.
Yeah. Yeah, there are two phrases that really set me on edge when I hear them. I don't follow the news, and I do my own research.
Oh, yeah.
But look, on this issue, I have no doubt that Iran would prefer anyone but Donald Trump as the 47th president of the United States. Trump's renunciation of the 2015 nuclear deal, something he did in 2018, and his reimposition of economic sanctions deprived Tehran of the cash it needed to support its allies in places like Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Yemen. But much of that cash has been recouped during the Biden administration, which for a variety of reasons has not enforced sanctions on Iranian oil exports to China in particular. I would hope that, if there's going to be a Harris administration, I would hope that administration finally realizes that Iran, under current management, is a permanent adversary of the United States. The mullahs who run that country are permanently anti-American. They need anti-Americanism as an ideological legitimizing force to cover up their own incompetence and corruption. So I think Iran should be careful about trying to manipulate the American system. I suspect most of their efforts will focus on trying to exacerbate tensions within the United States over the Gaza situation. Trying to increase American distrust of American institutions. That's, I don't know how successful it'll be, but that I think is where their focus will be, rather than trying to endorse or manipulate things in favor of one candidate or the other.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We will continue on this topic, maybe getting a little bit more into the Kremlin and Russia as it applies after regional news. The panel this morning, Fred Hoff, Jay Jochnowitz, Judy Patrick. I'm Sarah LaDuc, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuc, in studio with Senior Fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. The panel music this morning is by Styx and Foreigner, playing at SPAC in Saratoga Springs tonight, SPAC.org. The playlist is posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. You can join the panel conversation by emailing us at panel@WAMC.org. Before the break in the regional newscast, we were discussing potential election interference from U.S. election interference from Iran and Russia. And we will continue the conversation by reading this letter from a listener. Jonathan says, why shouldn't Iran be able to meddle in other countries and exercise influence in whatever way? America has through history done that, including meddling in other countries' elections and at times backing coups. And don't tell me backing Pinochet, for example, was in the service of spreading democracy. Why shouldn't Iran be able to cover its incompetence and corruption by its actions? Should the U.S. be the only country allowed to do that? Rather a, what would we call it, cynical take, but maybe fair in a lot of ways.
Well, I hope the listener believes that the United States and the American public should successfully defend itself against this kind of interference. As a general matter, I tend to put the home team first, and this kind of equivalence doesn't appeal to me very much.
It's we have a checkered history on this point, that the interests we serve are not always that of the noble principles of democracy in our foreign policy. But I don't. I tend to agree with you, Fred. If I'm going to go with the one bad player in the world, I'm going to take the least of all the evils. And what was it that Winston Churchill said? It's like, democracy's capitalism's a terrible system, or democracy's a terrible system, except for all the others. I tend to fall the same way. That eventually, I do think that ultimately the United States stands for something good. And that warts it all, as they say. On the social media and Iran interference, there's a meme on Facebook that I love, and I always wish I had.
Oh, JJJ.
I know that I had kept on my computer. It's a children's book. It looks just like a real children's book, and it's a little kid sliding down a hill looking so happy, and the title of the book is Everyone Who Disagrees With Me is a Nazi. And it's so good. And it, I was thinking about it today or yesterday when I was on Facebook, and somebody wrote, I thought, a very cogent criticism of something I had posted. It was about an editorial we had written about Biden's withdrawal from the race. And I...
Written prior to the withdrawal or after?
It was written after the withdrawal. Written after the withdrawal. And we thought it was a good speech and that it was a dignified speech and a graceful exit and everything that Trump was not, which is kind of what the editorial really was about. It was both things. But as I read this, I always bristle when somebody gives me a really good argument because, that's your first instinct. You're disagreeing with me, and B, you're doing it really well.
Yeah.
And my first impulse was to think, whose bot is this? And I thought, wait a second. First of all, it's too intelligent an argument to be a bot. And second, there's nothing uncivil about this. The guy just disagrees with me, and he's very firm about it. And yet, I think that that is kind of, you were talking before, you know, what should Iran do? And what shouldn't it do? And I think what it shouldn't do is it shouldn't look like it's endorsing Trump, because Trump is just going to run with that. Look at me. You know, they hate me because I'm so tough. Sowing discord, sowing suspicion of each other, I think is more effective. And social media is the perfect place for that to happen. We just are so at each other's throats on that, on any platform, really, that all you got to do is just keep throwing a little gas, sprinkle gasoline on it.
Judy?
Yeah, I think the Trump campaign definitely will use this information about Iran supporting or working against him as campaign fodder. It's just classic. I mean, they've always criticized the Biden administration for the position on Iran. Expect that to continue tenfold going forward with this information.
Jay writes in and says, good morning, panel. How much do you think Iran defers to Russia's wants and needs and all their actions in the Near East, Gaza, Lebanon, et cetera?
I think Iran very much has its own agenda in the Middle East. I mean, it's certainly demonstrated even before the onset of the so-called Islamic Republic, even during the time of the Shah. Iran had its, own agenda. Iran certainly needs things from Russia, weaponry and so forth, and Russia considers Iran to be a useful ally in the region. And Iran, indeed, has a thriving drone industry, and has provided drones that Russia has used to. To attack and terrorize civilians in Ukraine. So there is a relationship between these two countries, and I wouldn't be inclined to say that Iran is a tool of Moscow. There's a give and take. None of it any good, but there is give and take.
This is also a point made by the Washington Post in the article about potential election interference. It says China probably does not plan to influence the presidential election, though U.S. spy agencies are monitoring the possibility that pro-Beijing actors might seek to denigrate down-ballot candidates, as they did in a handful of midterm races in 2022. President Xi Jinping pledged to Biden at a summit in San Francisco in November that Beijing would not interfere in the election.
Well, you could take that to the bank, I'm sure.
I know, I also did appreciate the phrasing, China probably does not plan to influence the presidential election. It's like a sentence with, no solid anything.
Yeah.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Speaking, as we often to always are, of the election, let's talk about the latest in the Harris campaign. Scrolling to my notes. Harris. Vice President Kamala Harris highlighted endorsements from mayors of border towns in swing state Arizona on Monday as she looks to blunt the impact of Republican criticism of her handling of illegal border crossings. Harris's campaign said she was backed by the mayors of Bisbee, Nogales, Somerton, and San Luis, as well as by Yuma County Supervisors Martin Porchas and Tony Reyes. The mayors were elected without party affiliation but represent left-leaning communities. They are Democrats. The mayors were elected without party affiliation. Porchas and Reyes are Democrats. A week into her sudden promotion to the top of the Democratic presidential ticket, Harris is getting her campaign off the ground and refining her pitch to voters with less than 100 days before Election Day. Republicans are trying to make the border a political liability for Harris, just as it was for President Joe Biden before he ended his reelection campaign. I also want to discuss the Zoom meetings that have been happening for President Harris. But first, let's talk specifically about the endorsements of mayors on the border towns. Do we think this will have an impact? Judy?
Oh, it can't hurt at this point. And it does a good job of maintaining the momentum that she's built. That's one of the questions that we've all had, is whether or not that can be sustained. She still is driving the news cycle and still giving people an opportunity to figure out who she is and what she stands for. So I thought it was a smart move. I expect some counter programming from the Republican side. I haven't seen it yet. But it was a good move. immigration remains a big issue. But, you know, sometimes I wonder whether or not it really is a big issue with all voters, or whether or not it's an issue because the Republicans have tried to make it an issue, and whether it will really go away. When I think about our community, this isn't, immigrants are not a danger to us, and I don't hear a lot of people worried about it. So maybe this issue will kind of dissolve over time.
I think they're going to keep stoking it, and, mm-hmm. and it'll be, if they can tie it to the economy, you know, which has long been done. The idea that immigrants are taking people's jobs and so forth has been a long running narrative. So if you can tie it to, you're not just miserable because of inflation, you're miserable because of immigration, you know, and then, you know, there is the, unfortunately, I think we're probably going to feel more and more of the great replacement theory echoes and so forth, about people being imported just to vote for Democrats. Probably going to hear more of that. And then there was another story about more Chinese showing up at the border as well. And you know, we'll talk about Venezuela if we have time today, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, more Venezuelans. There does seem to be an acknowledgement, at least from the mainstream media that I've read, that there is a problem at the border in terms of being overwhelmed. There's also an acknowledgement that some of Biden's efforts have made a big impact. Fortunately or unfortunately for Harris, the actions Biden has taken are very Trumpian. So he's revived, you know, the Trump policies on asylum, the restrictions on asylum claims. And, you know, it's a weird thing. You know, he's also talking about tariffs in China. I mean, these are Trump ideas. So it all gets really muddled. But I don't think immigration is going to go away.
Right. You're seeing this influx of immigrants from Venezuela, less so from Mexico and Guatemala at this point, because of what's happening in Venezuela. Yep. And that is a difficult issue to resolve or to tone down. I agree. Immigration, especially when you see images of what's happening at the border and how those border towns are being overrun and just can't handle the influx, it is a real issue. But I think unemployment is low. Most people who are objecting to immigrants, they have good jobs. They don't want the jobs that the people from other countries are eager to do. So I think that position needs to be out there a little bit more as well.
Yeah, for obvious reasons, the Trump campaign is trying very hard to identify the vice president with those things that, according to polls, a strong majority of American voters consider to be major Biden administration policy failures, securing the southern border and inflation. Those are the two things that head the list. On securing the border, the Trump campaign is understandably exaggerating the role and responsibility of the vice president for what's happened over the past three-plus years. But it is not exaggerating the fact that most voters believe President Biden has failed to perform a very basic duty as commander-in-chief in terms of securing our border. And to be sure, there's plenty of blame to go around for this situation. Congress, not all that long ago, failed to enact a bipartisan fix, you know, a failure that was dictated by President Trump, who was eager to hold on to the border situation as a campaign issue. And Judy, as you were saying, we've got corruptly incompetent, violent governance in places like Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua. Countries are being literally emptied by their own incompetent governments, and for that matter, we as American citizens, I think, should shoulder some of the blame here. It's our demand for illegal drugs that keep drug cartels in business and undermine governance in multiple countries south of the border.
panel@wamc.org to join the conversation. Go ahead, Jay.
Oh, okay. I do think that, just to return to the original point, that I think Harris, this is the right thing for her to do, to start putting herself out there before Trump, the Trump campaign, defines her anymore. You really want to define yourself. So she's getting out there, defining herself as someone who's positive on immigration, you know, has a good perception from people who are right in the thick of it. So that's helpful, even if, you know, they are left-leaning and, you know, this is, you know, kind of man bites, dog bites man sort of endorsement.
We need a rational discussion of immigration, yeah, which we haven't had. If you have former President Donald Trump talking about other countries emptying their insane asylums, which is a term I don't even think was used anymore, or sending all their criminals and emptying their prisons, that's not a rational discussion of where we stand as a nation in terms of accepting immigrants or needing immigrants. So until the level of political discourse ratchets down, I don't think we're ever going to solve this problem. We're just going to use it as a political issue, which is clearly what Donald Trump wants.
I'd like to see Harris take maybe even more ownership of that czar thing. I mean, it was a mistake. Some media outlets kind of jumped the gun when they first reported on this and gave her the title of immigration czar. But if she would own what her job really was, I think she could make a pretty good case to the American people that she is the right person for this and start that same discussion. That this was about her role, as I understood it, was about dealing with the countries that we're getting a lot of immigration from, particularly in the triangle, the Northern Triangle, and doing something about the conditions in those countries that are driving people out of those nations and to our border. So, to say that and to say this is not something you do overnight to change whole economies and whole government cultures of nations, but we are starting this and we'll continue it. I think there's a good case to be made.
Yeah, I think her challenge is to make a compelling argument that our objective need for immigration, you know, in a population that's aging and, you know, in a population that needs additional workers, that need can be, you know, can coexist with rule of law. OK, the Biden administration itself is moving in this direction belatedly. OK, we obviously, you know, the United States is a sovereign power. We are entitled to secure our border. Yes, fair treatment of asylum seekers is mandated by international law. But how do we reconcile that with the fact, at least I believe it's a fact, that most people claiming asylum are actually coming, understandably, actually coming for economic reasons. Okay. And whether the Harris campaign likes it or not, a strong majority of Americans believe A, it's an important issue, and B, the Biden administration did not perform well. So her ability to articulate a different approach to the problem, I think, can answer the Trump view that all of this is a zero sum game, with, you know, asylums being emptied and everybody crossing the border from Mexico is stealing a job from a hardworking American.
Or a terrorist.
Or terrorist.
Or a criminal.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I'd like to note that when my grandfather came to this country from Ireland back in like 1918, 1920, he came for economic reasons. You know, there was no land left in Ireland, and he sent money home to his mom for, you know, decades afterwards. Even that's what our country was about for many years. He's unskilled. He worked in the you know, granite mines or the slate mines up in northern Washington County. That's what we did as a country, and that's one of the reasons we're a great country today.
Panel@wamc.org to join the conversation. Another story involving the Harris campaign that I didn't send you guys, but I have complete faith that as I read this little bit, you'll be able to comment on it because it's not a very complicated idea. Actor Jeff Bridges addressed a fundraising event geared toward white men supporting Vice President Kamala Harris and sang her praises on Monday night. Other participating self-identified white dudes on the White Dudes for Harris meeting included celebrities Mark Ruffalo, Bradley Whitford, and Mark Hamill. Also participating, Democratic officials, including Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. The call lasted more than 3 hours, and organizers said it attracted 180,000 plus people, over 180,000 people who donated more than $3.7 million. It was the latest in a series of Zoom gatherings to raise money and rally support among tens of thousands of supporters for Harris. Zooms have previously been organized. I believe there were three major ones just last night or yesterday afternoon. Zooms have previously been organized by supporters from different backgrounds, including Black women, Hispanic women, Black men, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and the LGBTQ plus community. The Zoom calls haven't been organized by Harris's team, but her campaign welcomes the assist and the millions of dollars in fundraising, of course. This is a new thing, big Zoom meetings organized by contingents of the population for a presidential candidate. What are we thinking?
How do they crowd all those little screens onto one screen so you can see everybody on a 180,000 person call?
I don't think you can.
I want to see myself with, you know.
I think you can see probably who's speaking when it is Jeff Bridges or Mark Ruffalo or Bradley Whitford. Yeah.
I think it's a, you know, it's a cute, funny, and smart idea. Where, you know, if politics has taught us nothing else in the last 10 years at least, if not more, we are tribal. In our reactions to things, or we can be. So, you know, if Trump owns the idea of white nationalism and the idea that I'm the party of white people, that's a problem since so many people in this country are white. So it's smart for Harris to say, hey, white people like me too. So do Black people, so do Brown people, so do, you know, all these other folks. And nothing, you know, breakthrough about it or anything. It's good for her, somebody to own it if she does.
Judy?
You know, I guess it's good for her campaign, you know, building coalitions. But I don't like it. I think I don't like the idea of segregating us into different kinds of people. I felt excluded from all of them. And there was something about it, and it's probably just where I'm coming from because everybody else seems really excited by it. But I just felt excluded.
Fred?
Yeah, like Judy, I'm not a big fan of identity politics. But you know, but that said, if who was the I would say if the Harris campaign could actually turn Hulk Hogan. That could be decisive.
That's not happening.
That could be decisive. And
I can see the future in this one instance.
Short of that, where's Jesse Ventura these days? He's still around? I mean.
I was surprised. I thought there was a country western star or two that went with her or with Biden. And I was surprised to see that. I mean, that's really against the grain. And I can't remember who it was.
Oh, well, but to have the original dude, the original white dude on the call, that turned my head for a moment. Okay. Again, I wasn't invited to that call.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Pardon me. Once again, the email address is panel@WAMC.org. Our panelists this morning are senior fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Again, you can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@WAMC.org. We have one more block of the show before we wrap up today, and we will talk about the protests in Venezuela and the election results in quotes. That coming up after news from the BBC. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel on WAMC. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke here with Fred Hoff, Jay Jochnowitz, and Judy Patrick. The music this morning from Styx and Foreigner. They're playing at SPAC tonight in Saratoga Springs, SPAC.org. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. And now we weave into our world web of stories updates on the Venezuelan elections. As thousands of people demonstrated across Venezuela, opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez announced Monday that his campaign has the proof it needs to show he won the country's disputed election in which electoral authorities named President Nicolas Maduro the victor. Gonzalez and opposition leader Maria Corina Machado told reporters that they told reporters that they have obtained more than 70% of tally sheets from Sunday's elections, and they show Gonzalez with more than double Maduro's votes. Both called on people, some of whom protested in the hours after Maduro was declared winner, to remain calm and invited them to gather peacefully at 11 a.m. Tuesday to celebrate the results. Their announcements came after the National Electoral Council, which is loyal to Maduro's ruling United Socialist Party of Venezuela, officially declared him the winner, handing him his third six-year term. Venezuelans vote using electronic machines, which record votes and provide every voter a paper receipt that shows the candidate of their choice. Voters are supposed to deposit their receipt in a ballot box before exiting the polls. After polls close, each machine prints a tally sheet showing the candidates' names and the votes they received. So the tally sheets, if not interfered with, may be able to prove the actual tally of votes one way or another. But it's Maduro. It's Venezuela. We shall see. Jay.
You know, the more I thought about this and the more I read about it, the more I just wanted to make my head explode. There's every reason to believe from international observers, from all sorts of independent reports outside of the immediate, players in Venezuela, that this was a bad election, and that the results are not what they seem to be. But we've talked repeatedly today about what disinformation does, and as an American reading these stories, I'm sitting there with, oh, so this is election denial is what, in this case, it happens to be from the right, the political right in Venezuela, which is kind of where we are in America. And so my mind is just like spinning with, is this true? Is it not true? That's, probably the most fundamental thing that I'm wondering. The distrust of elections, the distrust of election denialism, is inescapable when you're looking at stuff like this. But so is, I would think, the opinion of a lot of observers here. And then you add to that people are voting with their feet in this country. They are. This is one of the reasons we have such a big problem at the southern border, is because people are leaving this country in particular. To get out of a terrible situation. The inflation rate stunned me. It was 150,000% or 350,000% hyperinflation there under this guy. And then just throw into the fact that we've long had the United States as a capitalist nation has long had a combative, that's not the word I'm looking for, a relationship with any kind of Marxist socialist government in this hemisphere. So all that together. But it does seem as if there's a real problem in this country, and I don't know how you deal with it when, short of Venezuelans taking this to the streets is what they're doing here peacefully so far. But I have a feeling that if the election results are truly as lopsided as the opposition says it is, I think there's going to be real social strife before this is over.
Fred? Yeah, one can at least hope, I guess, that security forces in Venezuela that will almost inevitably be ordered to fire on demonstrators. Will decline to do so. I certainly hope so. And I realize Maduro and his predecessor Chavez, have gone out of their way to shovel benefits toward military officers and police officers. But if they decline to uphold this regime, that could lead to significant change. I think there's very little doubt that in this case the election is being stolen. The government has resolutely refused to produce any documentation, some of which seems to have fallen into the hands of the opposition. Exit polls suggested that the opposition candidate beat Maduro by a 2-to-1 margin. But you know the salient fact about Venezuela is that a country that should be easily at the top of the economic performers of Latin America has been wrecked by Chavez and Maduro. Just as the so-called leftists, socialists, Marxists in Cuba have wrecked the country. I noticed, I think it was in the New York Times the other day, they're doing an interview in Cuba, and this one Cuban fellow said, you know, if we had land borders, if Cuba had land borders, this country would empty in about 20 minutes. Well, Venezuela does have land borders, and Venezuela is emptying some of it in the direction of other Latin American countries, some of it in the direction of the United States.
It's too bad with all that oil wealth. I mean, they have the world's biggest
reserves. You really have to work at wrecking Venezuela. But that's what these clowns have done for the last quarter century.
Yeah, it was once the richest country.
Yeah.
And now it's the people are fleeing en masse. As I started to read these stories and hear this news, I didn't know what to believe as well, because, you know, we have gone through our whole own problems with election denialism. But, you know, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, he was out there saying it's very clear that there are significant problems here. And then there was polling before the election that showed that Maduro was going down to defeat. It seems very clear to me, and unless I'm presented with evidence to the contrary, that, you know, the election was stolen. What will happen going forward? It is, you know, it is nice to see people peacefully protesting this. And I mean, I saw one statue knocked down, not peaceful, destruction of property, but it was of Chavez. So perhaps that can make a difference. We've seen it happen before, but we've seen it go awry as before. I agree with you, Fred. I hope the military respects the rule of law. I hope there is a rule of law down there that will look at the election results and do the right thing at this point.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Panel at WAMC.org. Mike writes in on this topic and says, regarding the hyperinflation in Venezuela, yeah, we did that through a crippling sanctions regime. Sanctions are an instrument of economic war. The United States has routinely used sanctions to cripple the economies of rival states, especially those who are left-wing governments gain foothold. We wrecked Venezuela. We have done that throughout Latin America, and then act as if it's self-evident that socialism is an inferior form of government.
You know, this blame America first sentiment. I don't get it. I mean, American sanctions have had a negative effect on Venezuela. They have had a negative effect on a place like Syria. But they are nothing compared to the internal corruption and incompetence of the political classes in these countries.
Panel at WAMC.org. Jay, did you have?
No. Actually, that was the point I was going to make, was that it is fair to say that the current wave of migration that we're seeing from Venezuela and the upswing or the downturn in its economic fortunes, can be traced to some degree back to Trump, but I believe it predates that. They've been mismanaging
the Biden administration agreed to sanctions relief in Venezuela, in return for, I think it was release of political prisoners, in return mainly for a commitment to a free election. And Maduro said yes to all the above, but in the end, he realized that to give up power was just something he was not going to do. you know, sort of blame the United States for this, I think is a little bit extraordinary.
I'm surprised that Trump and he don't get along better.
Panel at WAMC.org. Several listeners have written in wanting to convince Judy that the Zoom meetings for Harris are good. So I'm going to read you their feedback. This is from Nicholas. Red, Wine, and Blue had a nationwide Zoom last night as well as Women for Harris. I did not feel left out or disenfranchised. I was just happy to see focus and support for VP Harris's campaign for president. Wendy writes in and says, I had a similar reaction to the Zoom call for white women last night, but I attended one that was open to all women. It was attended by people from Gloria Steinem to Rep. Pramila Jayapal to lesser-known black activists to a mother for gun control. It was inclusive and inspiring and raised a lot of money for Harris, as well as recruiting many volunteers, as all these Zooms have. That from Wendy. Then Jean writes in and says, your panel is missing the point. It's reclaiming the identity politics from MAGA. It's like when gay people took back the term queer, making it a source of pride versus a smear. The first Zoom was black women. We've learned to listen to black women. The next was white women for Harris, and it moved many black women to see allies after the press keeps saying white women are for Trump. And the Harris campaign is multicolored, multicultural one. These Zooms aren't staying in silos. It's about reclaiming our democracy.
Oh, I love that letter.
Maybe it's just because I'm an introvert.
But That could be.
But if Gloria Steinem was on one of them, I might have been there. But you know, maybe I'm just antisocial.
That's okay. We have one more letter on that topic. Scott writes in and says, I was on the white dude call. While I did find the concept a little awkward, I also respect the creative outreach. I suppose that it is a recognition that we are, at least to an extent, tribal, as Jay mentioned. While I would never describe myself as a white dude, indeed I am, in the end, it was an informative and energizing call that will drive support for the Harris ticket. Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. We have a few minutes left here. What would you guys like to talk about?
I would just punctuate that by saying, yes, I'm very conflicted because with my Semitic background during the summer, I'm not exactly white. So,
well, yes, you are and aren't, right?
But I really liked that letter, the idea of reclaiming identity politics. You know, the right wing has been very good about saying that it is not about identity politics. And the more it says that, the less I believe it. And they make identity politics, you know, it's like saying we're not about identity politics. And then they just keep repeating that, which makes it identity politics. So I love the idea of putting it that simply, that reclaiming that.
And not staying in silos was one of the other letters said.
Yeah.
Right. That identity politics is not bad by itself.
By itself, no, it's not.
What do you think, Fred?
You know, the only thing that sort of pops into my mind is a column that Tom Friedman has written for the New York Times, and it's not exactly identity politics, but he's warning Democrats against adopting the word weird.
To describe Trump and his campaign
and Trump supporters, right. that this is just another kind of the arrogance, the deplorables sort of thing that will convince people that they are looked down upon, that they're being marginalized, that they are victims, and that their only option is to support the Make America Great Again movement.
Yeah, weird worked for a bit, but I think it's now being overused.
Yeah, it's like everything else.
I had
overused.
Did I use that word?
No.
There was who did originally say
one of the surrogates, one of the governors said, you know,
governor of Minnesota.
That's right.
Yeah.
And effectively just said, you know, they just seem weird to me, and it resonated with people for a while. But now every surrogate out there is just saying, yeah, they're just weird. And so it is being overused. But I you're right. The Hillary Clinton's use of deplorables
didn't help.
It's such an awkward phrase, too. A basket of deplorables. That is a group. That is a collection of words I would never put together to begin with.
Right, but the idea that you are dissing a whole group of people is not something I think the Democrats should proceed with.
Our panel this morning was Senior Fellow at the Bard Center, at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Thank you all, as always, for your conversation, your presence, your willingness to participate. We appreciate you.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
The panel will be posted on our website, wamc.org/roundtable, in a little while here, a little bit after 11 a.m. We will get that online for you. The Congressional Corner is next.